Andy.
Graham, good afternoon. Thanks for your patience. The sole survivor from last night of our triumvirate. How late
Well,
did you stay up?
country first, party second.
It does feel a little bit Maoist, doesn't it?
No, that's the Constitution. I mean,
Well, that's true. That's true, yes.
that's what Theresa May didn't get,
I
nor
suppose
all the rest.
I'm right. Who's now been made a dame by Sunak, I see.
Oh, has she? Well done. Well done.
Having
Yes.
lost her seat to a Lib Dem, like so many.
Did she? Right. I'm not, you're much better up on the individual.
I defer to my p political editor colleague Cam, who was encyclopedic.
Right.
We were, I have to say, the pace of events at 4 a.m. was humongous. There were three different counts declaring at the same time, three different locations. And we could hear it all, and we were trying to take it all in. And of course, the equipment did what the equipment does. But, we got there in the end. Anyway,
Yeah.
being that as it may, as the smoke clears on last night's shenanigans, are you impressed in hindsight by what Starmer's achieved? Some people have said that he wasn't that strong on message, but basically anything but the incumbents for the past 14 years.
Yeah, you have to take it that he did it his way. Just hung on to the Ming vase strategy. So I mean now I it's whether he can actually deliver. So no, I think it's all very impressive. I mean, you can't say that he could have done it a better way.
Does it feel a little bit like 1997 and things can only get better? Personally, image
Oh,
making.
yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yes, but he couldn't say that because of the economic situation, and actually the global situation. Because now he's got to start the company as soon as possible and get it on the road.
So you have this, in that sense, you have this sense of a bit of austerity. I see George Osborne was on one of the major channels last night, indeed today, and the John Major effect, if it isn't hurting, it's working, back to basics. And then this air of caution that is, I would have thought, a very hard sell in terms of image making. I mean, he suddenly smiles, but it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, but his acceptance speech, I mean, he'd obviously, cometh the hour, cometh the man moment. It's a very good acceptance speech.
There was a significant challenge in Holborn and St Pancras from a guy called Andrew Feinstein, the South African former politician, now investigative journalist over here, who was the guy Al Jazeera went to about the anti-Semitism debacle, whose independent findings suggested, because he's had a background as, I think, a sort of a South African constitutional lawyer, he'll be more in this conversation with this than I, that all of the due process was completed before Corbyn became leader. So, I mean, basically, the argument was after the fact. So, parking that, it was still political hay to be made. And on the back of it, a very directorial stance. So I was in Brixton Town Hall last night, and none of the Labour politicians wanted to talk to the media at all, bar one. We had a very hard time with getting activists to speak to us as well. So it's a bit of a news blackout in the midst of this otherwise air of, gathering euphoria. Strange combination. And I wonder if that's it, whether that will speak to the public as well, and whether that's about this caution, what we can and can't say, what may or may not be.
Well, that's a whole different slant. I mean, if he carries on as he's won, then that's a totally different scenario because
Cannot believe
now
that and all that,
he's and but I read it that he was saying change starts now. This is when the changes start, not before. He's changed the Labour Party internally, and now he's going to change the country and change everything.
And his argument is that the one was the necessary prequel to the what now happens.
Yeah, and it's still a question of forgiving him for not telling us what he's going to be doing, and certainly things like not keeping in touch with the people and keeping the people informed. I mean, this is the whole difference between the Conservatives, is that we should all be well informed to be able to make well informed decisions to have this participatory democracy.
And not just about the date of the election, from which one might duly profit if one was a certain echelon.
Well, they certainly collapsed in a big way, didn't they? It is the worst situation, which is, it was all there before. I mean, it wasn't a surprise at all. It's just still amazing to watch, you know, how low can you go?
There was a lone guy who was also a sort of ambassador for conservatives in Europe, conservatives abroad, Leon Cole, I think his name was, and he was saying that he's a one nation Tory, and there are many others out there, and they've got to go back to that. Whereas the whole nation has moved to the centre ground. His contention was that Labour have stolen the march on what the Tories used to be able to offer in terms of a sort of compassionate conservatism.
Yeah, they have to go back to Churchill, and Europe.
Now there's a thought.
It's Churchill that said we should all join together. You know, be like he was saying we should be like United States of Europe.
Yeah, but with his sort of part American background.
Yeah.
But who do we have, you know, wandering over to the channel there? But well, we have a sort of a right-wing government installed in Holland now after much sort of horse trading. And Le Pen on the brink or not, due to the very peculiar French electoral system, which I was trying to get my head around. I suspect you're much more conversant than I am.
Well, they're voting. There's three parties gone into the final round, the second round. And so now they all vote again on Sunday. So it's hopefully Starmer will have given the left, because the left did finally come together on the backs of a threat of Le Pen. So which is what Macron wanted in a way. he wanted them to come together with him rather, but they didn't. So he's still out in the cold and is refusing to combine with the left coalition. But the left coalition, I think, is in a very good position. And I think Starmer will give them heart that you know, the left can manage the country, even under Macron, because of course Macron stays, whatever.
And yes, and presumably has a bit of a sticky wicket. Rather as if, say, Biden was as he was for a time, was governing with a Republican Congress. So, Graham, we were in the break there. We were talking about the fact that you've pre-planned a major art touring exhibition in France, and I'm thinking about that in relation to the pending political weather, which is by no means resolved. We have the situation where, as we were saying just now, that the centre and the left are standing down in coalition to prevent a split in the vote, and thus, they think, prevent Le Pen from succeeding. But if that doesn't work out, what then happens to things like the creative industries and to certain aspects of the French way of life?
Well, I think the left and centre have got through to the second round. So it's a runoff between the two. The three, with Le Pen group. So everyone's hoping that the left coalition is going to gain, because Macron's party is clearly out of favour. So it would be forcing Macron to work with the left, as I understand it.
Can we talk about how Macron got to this place? Because he was, as I remember the great big pension strike and things like that. There was a sort of I don't know, Starmer-esque pragmatism going on there. Sort of, it isn't hurting. If it isn't hurting, it isn't working. And then just a step too far. He felt perhaps that he could carry people a bit further than he was able to in the sort of French equivalent of the Overton window. And yet the reaction to that has been to mobilize the far right, who presumably would do something even more extreme, but just in with a different mindset or projectile mindset. How does that work?
The political life in Paris is coming around to accepting Le Pen. I mean, she's not shunned as she used to be, which was the first sign of some kind of acceptance. And they've got a new potential prime minister.
He's the young pretender, isn't he? He's got a young chap,
Yeah,
Devon Adonis.
would be the youngest ever, I think. He's I don't know how old he is, but he's young.
It's a curious thing, isn't it? A young man with that sort of, approach to public life and life in general, sort of unchecked and unfiltered.
Well, apparently, the young are the people who are going to the right quite often. There's a lot of young extreme right players. Gary Lineker was interesting.
He often is indeed, yes.
who go
What a learned man.
the people who go to football academies don't get to be a footballer. Two of them turned up as extreme right wing attacks in Paris, apparently. That I may have got that story wrong, but it was basically right that academy failures turned up as terrorists in Paris.
You remind me loosely of the plot of a novel by Frank Delaney called Pearl, which features a happens to be gay Dutch footballer who uncovers links within rigged matches and things like that to a fictional far right. But as ever with journalists, sometimes journalists who write novels, it's often a veiled version of something that could very easily have happened and might yet happen.
Yeah, I've just finished reading the book, extraordinary book, Killers of the Flower Moon, which was
Oh,
made
yeah,
into.
on which the Scorsese film is based.
That is an extraordinary story, and it's what people talk about when they talk about conspiracies. They're not talking about some totally made up story,
It's
you
the
know.
sort of domino theory, I suppose, isn't it? The runaway train, eventually, to make metaphors.
Well, it was according to the book. I haven't seen the film actually, but it was the birth of the FBI.
Oh, now it can be told.
And it is it, they've got lots and lots of photographs in the book, and it's definitely all the stories about cowboys and Indians that we saw movies of
Yes,
growing up.
exactly. And I suppose it must link to the systemic, erasure of some Native American tribes.
Yeah, it's how the myths were created about cowboys and Indians, partly in absolute shame for what the reality was of how the fossil industry, when the government had moved the Indians onto a reservation, and subsequently found that the reservation was worth stacks of money from oil.
Yes.
Then there is a real horrendous conspiracy to simply kill off the Indians to get the head rights of the oil for the oil. And it's a really horrendous story.
And such a powerful story to tell in an election year. Let's bring in Leonie. Thanks for your patience. Thanks for your forbearance with the technology. After last
Pat's
night, my
hello.
dear, how are you?
Hello, Andy. Oh, well, actually, nothing to do with last night at all, but I've just got a filthy cold.
All the
So,
more, thank you. Prodigious thank yous for being here.
you're still enjoying the moment, presumably.
Yeah. It's yeah, it was not exactly helped by running around all most of yesterday, trying to secure the election of Labour MPs, although in general, that task appears to have been quite efficiently carried out.
Yes, and you've been well thanked by the leader this morning. You have done it.
Wow, quite. 412, with two more seats to declare.
Incredible.
It's
Humble.
yeah, I think there are some really gratifying elements to the result as far as Labour is concerned, but obviously there's some slightly worrying trends if you look at the percentage of the Conservative vote and the percentage of the Reform UK vote. If you add them together, that's actually almost 40% of voters voting for two parties who were being pretty openly xenophobic during the
Yeah.
election campaign. Almost 40% of everyone who voted. That's really quite a worry. I'm also worried that the actual turnout was very low as well. I mean, we've often thought that the around about 50% turnout for the London elections was low. Nationally, the turnout figure was barely above 50%, which, compared to previously when it used to be, 75, 80% in some seats, it's now, yeah, that's a real, so I think that is also a real worry that people just didn't feel they wanted to even go bother to vote at all. That's really concerning. Really,
I
really
was on the
concerning.
streets of Brixton for Riverside last night, and actually in the count at 4 a.m., which is, I have to say, superbly managed, but very, very fast. We were running basically between bits of information coming in us in all directions. Very excellent. But I on the street, everybody had an opinion about the election, but very often they weren't enthused by anything that was on offer.
No, which is a concern. But I mean, you can't have an election and not have an outcome. And I think that Labour had a very clear set of messages. Now, some people will argue and say, well, there should have been more messages, but I think having a clear set of messages, is a sensible thing to do, and also fought a very targeted campaign and made sure that the work was done in the right areas to try and win the requisite number of seats, which obviously is 326, but has obviously gone over that. So there's now a very healthy working majority, which is obviously, what you would want really for a prime minister.
What we haven't yet heard is the usual trope about national unity, which I suppose is implicit in what some of these plans are. But how do you see the whole thing functioning in Parliament as opposed to the drawing board exercise it's been, albeit with a great deal of electoral tactic? I suppose many of these people have held office before. Starmer is, I suppose, new to active political life at this level, isn't it? He's been in public life before. What
Well,
sorts of things should he bear in mind?
I'm not sure you could say that many of them have held office before. I mean, I think Pat McFadden and John Healey,
Oh, old sweat.
Hilary Benn, if he's in the cabinet again, Ed Miliband have all held sort of senior offices of state and been in the cabinet before. But if you think about, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, no, only became an MP in 2015, so an MP for less than 10 years. Angela Rayner, no. Rachel Reeves, likely to become the Chancellor, not held a ministerial position before either. David Lammy did hold ministerial positions, but not in cabinet. They were sort of more junior roles, that's assuming that he is retained in his shadow foreign secretary and then transfers over to foreign secretary role. So it will be interesting. There's going to be at least half of the cabinet who won't have held positions before. Wes Streeting's majority has been massacred as well. I don't know whether you saw that result. His majority has gone down to where it was when he first won the seat. It's gone back down to about 500.
I think it Curtis and others were thinking it might have gone Lib Dem.
No, he's held on. I think it was there was a an a pro Gaza candidate standing against him, or or I believe, or something like that. And obviously, Jeremy Corbyn won in Islington North.
Yes, I think there were, as it were, a strong word, but defections or transferals across pro tem from the Islington North Labour Party. Let's bite the bullet here. There was quite a big poster near the tube station, Brixton, on the way into the count, saying a vote for Starmer is a vote for genocide. What it said. I'm not defending this, but the people, I think particularly young people, are seeing this in stark, unnuanced terms.
It's clearly ridiculous. Even if Keir Starmer, as the then leader of the opposition, had come out and said Israel should leave the Gaza Strip now, and he'd done that on the 8th of October, like literally the day after, the Hamas atrocities on the 7th, even if he had started saying that the day after Hamas's activities, would it have actually made any difference to what the Likud-led coalition in Israel is doing? And clearly not. So this is a canal that has been put around by Galloway, who, thank heavens, has once again lost his seat. He is often used these sort of things to sort of try and beat the Labour Party with. And it is just nonsense to suggest that anything that Keir Starmer is the leader of the opposition in the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, that he could have said anything that would have changed events on the ground. Now,
the White House, though, is it? And I suppose people might suggest there's a sort of domino effect. If various world leaders say up with us, we will not put.
But then, I'm not an American Democrat. I'm a member of the British Labour Party.
Yeah, thinking of a special relationship sort of thing. The fact that we have Israeli defence companies in the UK. Which is another issue, I guess.
I was at the count last night, and I was personally insulted by somebody from the Workers' Party. I am not personally responsible for genocide in Gaza, nor is Keir Starmer. You know, that I do personally believe that perhaps we, as a government, Rishi Sunak should have been doing more to talk to the Americans about a ceasefire and a humanitarian pause, or whatever it was being called at one point. But urgently, we need a ceasefire now because things are, we have needed a ceasefire for a long time. Mm. And obviously, we shouldn't be selling arms to the Israelis at all. But there's a long list of other regimes who would be on my list that we should not be selling arms to as well. But I just think it's ridiculous for the Workers' Party to suggest that members of the Labour Party are responsible for genocide. No, that would be Benjamin Netanyahu, Likud, and the small fragment parties that prop up the Likud-led government in Israel. Our sister party in Israel is the Israeli Labour Party and is not Likud. And there are thousands of Israelis on the streets in Israel, probably even as we speak, who've been protesting against what Likud has been doing. And I just think this is just an absolute nonsense. And it has actually got to the point now where I feel quite angry that people are... I mean, there's a councillor who was a Labour member and is now sitting as an independent. Personally, I think she should be suspended as a councillor in Merton, who put out on social media lots of things about blood on the hands of Keir Starmer and this, that and the other. And she then went further and said that, it's a well-known fact that Jewish people are paedophiles. I mean, that's where this is where it goes to. You know, people start just sort of speaking complete nonsense.
It's interesting about optics, isn't it? I noticed, no doubt for the best of reasons, we couldn't get interviews with any of the Lambeth candidates last night. I think everybody went off to a big briefing, presumably at Labour headquarters.
I don't think so. I think they went off to a watch party. That's what we had.
Okay.
That's what.
See how
I don't
the rest
know.
Of things are panning out.
Were there interviews with the Wandsworth candidates / MPs? I don't know, but they came over to... We had one at Clapham Grand, and we had members from all three of the Wandsworth constituencies in the Clapham Grand, and then the three MPs all turned up and thanked everybody for all of the work that they put in. And
But
I believe they were doing the same in Lambeth, I think.
I should mention the wonderful Florence. It was kind enough to give me a few words on air. But
Yeah.
that it, I suppose I was also alluding to whether it's powerful acceptance speeches and so forth. But actually, the on message nature has happened the latter Blair years, and how this gives or merges into how political debate is going to feel, particularly as we were saying just now, when people are relatively new to it at cabinet level, and in terms of the new form of crossfire in the Commons with the likes of Farage waiting in the wings and saying we're coming for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think well, Farage can wait in the wings for a long time, but it's not he who will be getting, you know, the opportunity to ask a question every week at Prime Minister's Question Time. That was previously the Her Majesty's loyal opposition, which was Labour, and then the SNP, because they were the third largest grouping in the Commons. It will now be Her Majesty's loyal opposition. The Conservatives will get, you know, the initial questions to ask to Keir, whoever becomes their new leader, because Rishi's announced his resignation. And then the Liberal Democrats. So the Liberal Democrats will get a weekly question. They've gone back to that now because they've got they're way larger than the SNP. They've got, I think it's 71. And it might go up because there's these two other seats that still need to declare.
Given they're getting the proportional representation, it's a tad ironic, isn't it?
Mm.
What do you make of that, Graham? The rise of the Lib Dems. Did David play a good game?
Well, it's a very good sign, yes. Well, he used my art for his publicity campaign. So the message obviously got through. People understood that being in contact with reality was in preference to fantasy land of the populists. I think that generally is the message that's getting through, and hopefully it will transfer to France as well, and then into America. You know, despite Biden's age, I mean, I think he's still in more in contact with reality than Trump.
Yes, I suppose that, you know, that may not be saying very much, but at the same time, it's curious that there is this conjunction, isn't there, across the channel, and the situation in America where Biden might withdraw. I was thinking about this in the midst of the brouhaha at 4 a.m. and what it must have been like, the sheer stamina required to see a whole campaign through, and perhaps a family life and a constituency life. It really is some physical feat.
Yes, but he's lived his whole life in politics. It sounds very much like a sort of normal political pressure. I haven't seen his performance, but I've seen some of the other clips. And I think it's a question of ageism. You know, as you get older, you do get a bit doddery, but it doesn't mean to say that your judgment is impaired.
That's a very important point, Graham, yes. You might need a little more time, as it were, reasonable adjustment.
Well,
the news cycle doesn't always offer that, does it?
Well, exactly. It's the demand of some superhero type, fluent presenter that's the problem, not the reality of how difficult it is to make decisions.
And of course, pride goeth before a fall. There's something folksy about Biden, I always think, that, you know, as ever, if he makes a gaffe, it's something that perhaps other people might do. Do you concur with that, Leonie? Do you think he can see this through? Or can you see Michelle Obama stepping in, for example? There are other names on the frame.
Well, I think she's been asked many times and has always refused to. I think if it was going to be anybody, I think if it was going to be anybody, it would be more likely to be Kamala Harris than Michelle Obama, because, you know, Michelle has never run for any kind of elected office, let alone president. And my understanding is that she has never wanted to, that she supported Barack. Well, he did, but she herself hasn't wanted to do that. Personally, I don't think Biden can carry on. They've protected him from all of this stuff for all the time he's been in the White House. I can't even remember the last time he did a White House press conference himself, as opposed to it being you know, done by whoever his press secretary is. And part of politics is being able to participate in the rough and tumble of a hustings. Certainly in this country, we put our prime ministers through it every week because of prime ministers' question time. So, you know, people can put questions directly to them from other politicians. Now, it's slightly different in America because obviously he doesn't have to go before the Senate or the Congress or something like that. So when something like one of these presidential debates happens, he absolutely needed to be on his top form, and he totally wasn't. And I don't see how he can carry on, because Trump is just going to carry on exploiting it like mad. Absolutely like mad.
It's simply a question of who can possibly win against Trump. I think Biden's the only one that could, anybody else wouldn't stand a chance.
Well, I think Kamala Harris could potentially. I think the problem is going to be is if the Democrats are themselves starting to wobble about supporting him, then, you know, stepping aside might, you know, be the best thing to do. I can't.
It's sort of falling on your sword, isn't it?
I don't think he can beat Trump. That's the problem. I don't think he can. I just don't see how he can anymore. You know, and the politics in America is so polarized. You know,
that's the problem, isn't it? It's there are lots of Clactons out there, as it were, aren't there?
Yeah, it's really difficult, and the whole sort of social media landscape, and in their case, media landscape, means that people just end up only listening to people who are within their echo chamber.
Talk shows, as they call them,
by Putin.
So it would seem.
Well,
there was, I forget which organ it was suggesting this, but it was suggested the Kremlin might have been rather pleased with last night's result, which doesn't tally, you know, or may tally with a sense of foreboding in terms of what they may have coming down the pike in terms of banana skins.
But well, who knows what banana skins will emerge, because there's bound to be a few, aren't there?
Yeah,
inevitably.
I think we should
place outside the Kremlin as well for balance. Or not balance.
You can't believe or rely on anything the Kremlin does. So it's pointless second guessing what he's going to do.
Exactly. It's wheels within wheels, isn't it?
Hmm.
Graham and I were talking earlier on, Leonie, about the situation in France and the general gathering of the right in Europe at the moment, be it in, you know, Altility for Deutschland or the Geert Wilders ascending a sort of ragbag coalition in Holland, finally.
Netherlands, yeah.
Yeah, and indeed what might be coming up on Sunday, albeit I think there've been something like 200 tactical withdrawals, haven't there, to prevent a split in the vote.
Yes, and I think that if you look at actually what's just happened in the UK election, you can see why this works. And you can actually trace it back to the 1980s when Thatcher won all of her victories, because the sort of the centre-left vote was split between Labour and the SDP. Mm. And then the SDP merged with the Liberal Democrats and became the SDP Lib Dem Alliance, and it carried on, and it you know, and even into 1992, and that's why it took until 1997 when Labour kind of recolonized all of the centre ground, and people saw it as a united rather than a divided party, and was able to win a storming election. It's now happened in reverse. The people who are sort of like the anti centre left, let's say the Well, they're not even centre-right anymore. I think they're just right-wing, because Boris Johnson hollowed out the Conservative Party of people who were on the centre-right.
The Tories in Labour were bewailing last night. Where's the One Nation thing gone?
Yeah. It's gone. He chucked them all out, basically. Mm. And so, you know, you've ended up with their vote, even though they've tacked off to the right, has now been split between them and reform. So, of course, several seats where they might potentially have previously won, you know, they've lost. And that's why people like, you know, Penny Mordaunt has lost, Liz Truss has lost, gosh, the list, Grant Shapps has lost. I mean, the list of cabinet members, previous cabinet members, Jacob Rees-Mogg, another one. So Labour finding itself to the centre and to the left, but also not having three other parties, or, you know, in that space, has created this, you know, triumph, partly because the opposition on the right and the centre right is split all over the place. But what is interesting is seeing these, I think there's six independents and four Greens coming through. So that's quite interesting. And then, of course, in the southwest and the southeast of the country, the Liberal Democrats have done very well and picked up some seats in Wales and Scotland too. So, you know, they have also repositioned themselves into a new place. And the casualties are the Conservatives and the SNP, big time.
Yeah. I mean, the resurgence, I mean, in our immediate region here in southwest London, the emergence of the re-emergence of the Lib Dems is extraordinary. I mean, at local government level, they seem to be ghostly figures for the longest time. But plugging away seems to have won the day.
Well, yes, they've increased the number of MPs in London that they had from three Liberal Democrats to six. And if you think that Labour has managed to crush the Tories in many other constituencies, there are only nine Conservative MPs left in London, six Liberal Democrats and nine Conservatives. And that really tells quite a strong story about how London Labour has organised itself. I mean, the one aberration, obviously, was Islington North and Jeremy hanging on. And actually, the nine Conservative MPs in London, potentially, if the changing candidate that was rather brutally carried out in relation to Chingford and Woodford Green, the previous Labour candidate who stood as an independent got 12,000 votes. The last-minute Labour candidate who came in also got 12,000 votes, I think, and between them would have got, they got 24,000, so they would have beaten Ian Duncan Smith, who got 17 or 18. So it could have been even worse for the Conservatives.
Do you think, I mean, at a sort of psychological level, both of you, the end of this 14 years of very different political weather, how do people perhaps breathe a sigh of relief, change starts now? What is the fallout from that in terms of taking, as it were, due diligence, due care of public expectations? Because there are a few things left hanging, aren't there, from the previous administration? The immigration policy is one. Policing and knife crime, again, regionally, is another. And, you know, in a sense, I suppose, where do you start?
I think the big problem that we will see that the Labour government is going to need to grapple with is the dire financial circumstances that the country finds itself in, which is what, and the Conservatives' response has been to say, well, we're just going to cut everything. And of course, you know, the more that you cut things, then you end up with things like court backlogs, and you can't get any criminals to court. You have to cut the police, so it makes catching criminals more difficult. You don't give as much money to the police and crime commissioners to employ sufficient police across the country, and London is no exception from that. Local authorities are on their knees. They're not getting it, you know, the amount of money they've been getting through the annual settlements has been cut by 60% since 2010.
That's now, you can't,
which is why some of them started to go bankrupt and declaring these Section 114 bankruptcy statements. I mean, Birmingham is the largest local authority in the country and has had to declare itself bankrupt. Mm. Now, you know,
also,
if more...
Just as a sidebar to that, Leon, you saw it in Germany. One of the comments on the room last night for the Greens example, for the example we're referring to Croydon and other boroughs, was that Labour tends to overspend rather rashly, and it seems to be a sort of somewhat in the regional DNA. Again, I'm not defending that position, that's what they said. And that's perhaps also in the public consciousness as a part of their risk assessment.
Who said that? The Greens?
I think it was a Green MEP in Lambeth.
Well,
I mean, that, Well, that's ridiculous because the Greens manifesto, if you look through it, is completely uncosted moonshine, most of it. You know, some of it is very lovely. But, you know, Carla Donia and Adrian, whatever his name is, have just got elected on the back of a manifesto that is totally uncosted. And, you know, was talking about handing out money hand over fist, left, right and centre. So, I, you know, they've got a couple of things that they say that will bring in some extra cash, but nowhere near enough cash to cover what they're suggesting. So I think this is, but I do think Labour has tried very hard not to promise things that it wouldn't be able to afford. And I think it's nonsense to suggest that it's Labour councils that have in their DNA overspending. The council that has got the biggest, to use the terminology we all love, black hole in its finances is Woking. And Woking was being run by the Conservatives and they got themselves into property dealing and they have ended up with a black hole that is worth £2.1 billion. That is the biggest black hole in local government. Not surprisingly, voters in Woking, where the council goes out in thirds, have gradually been turning it into a Liberal Democrat-run council. And last night, they've just got rid of the Conservative MP and they've just elected a Liberal Democrat MP for Woking as well. So it's complete nonsense to suggest that these financial issues only relate to Labour councils. They absolutely do not.
So perhaps from what you're helpfully reminding us of there, there's been a general issue in terms of the way in which local government has been run.
It's about it's about the overall funding for the activities that local governments are expected to take on. And because of the cuts in the budgets, we've ended up with a situation where now the vast majority of local government expenditure is mostly going on adult social care. And even with all of that expenditure on adult social care, it's still almost impossible to find people to undertake domiciliary care in people's homes. It's an extremely depressing situation. I have spoken about it before. It's very, very sad.
Indeed, well, in my day job, I have a great bread with people who do this, and you see how stretched they are. Sometimes how under-trained they are and under-prepared for the scale of the task. And with an aging population. And this was so significant to the Lib Dems plans, wasn't it? No, perhaps there'll be some heads together on this one. Graham, what do you think of the tilt and where we're going with this?
Well, I think Rachel Reeves is very clear and very convincing that she'd got a handle on the economy. And it's just an old conservative trope that the Labour are just going to overspend.
So I don't... Also, in absentia, the excellent Mal Grimston's fourth law is that the reputation that Labour is for the good times and the conservative fiscal expectations, but that's been blown out of the water by various debacles under Johnson and Sunak and Truss.
Yeah, exactly. Generally, I mean, I think it's that the Labour have put in their fundamental policy change is to work through the local authorities. So there, I think, is where we're going to see the biggest change in the fastest time, hopefully. So they become economically viable.
And harnessing their expertise and helping them be part of the solution.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that in general, the Labour won it because the Conservatives were the Brexit party and Labour hasn't been too smeared with being a Brexit party, although it's going to have to face up to it pretty soon.
Well, Starmer says not in my lifetime, but do you think, particularly in terms of what you want to remind us about Article 50, is it, that we revisit this?
All he's got to say is we'll refer it to the courts. You know, politicians can't handle it, so we'll put it into the courts.
And given his prominence in a previous political life, that wouldn't be too difficult for Keir Starmer. Do you think that might ever happen? Given the balance of opinion going on in the country, I'm going to put that to Leonie, if I may.
I think they've got some other priorities first. I think what they will want to do is to improve the relationships with Europe, because one of the things that it's quite apparent is that the whole thing about the you know, the so-called small boats and these sort of, you know, these waves of migration where people are, you know, economic migrants or political migrants or whatever you want to call them, refugees. But, you know, with the changes in climate, this is not going to slow down. So I think, you know, cooperation across Europe on those kind of things, I think they will want to see a massive improvement. And then I think stuff like, you know, they started talking about Erasmus, which is the scheme for students to enable them to. And I think that's a really good way of getting people from different countries to understand other countries by going to work there or study there, you know. And I think that's a really good scheme. And there are still various aspects of Brexit that have not been implemented, and business is definitely pretty fed up with some of the sort of checks. We went for the sort of hardest of hard Brexits, and I think some of that, I think, is going to be ameliorated. Whether that will actually, in the short term, lead to a sort of relooking at, you know, the Brexit legislation, or whether it can be done through regulations and statutory instruments, I don't know. I suspect they probably go more down regs and statutory instruments and much better diplomatic relationships. I mean, it can hardly be, apart from the Prime Minister, who seemed to have a warm personal relationship with Giorgia Meloni from Italy. I struggle to think of any good relationships that he developed, Rishi Sunak, across Europe.
And I suppose part of the problem, particularly with the immigration problem, is that you're dealing with a Wilders and a Meloni and potentially Le Pen's prime minister, should things come to pass, who will, and therefore there will be a diplomatic role that's a post-European almost, or sub-European. I presume it would be David Lammy who would be leading on this
Well,
international development.
we actually don't know at
Home
this moment
Office.
in time, because Keir has actually got people going up Downing Street as we speak. The TV cameras are watching as people go up Downing Street. I think the only appointment that's just been confirmed in the last sort of 5 minutes is that Angela Rayner has been confirmed as the Deputy Prime Minister. And is going to keep her current portfolios, which are, as you probably know, so she will be the Secretary of State, not Shadow Secretary of State, for levelling up housing in communities. And she's going to keep that along with being the Deputy Prime Minister. So we've just reinvented, do you remember ODPM, the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, which was
Oh,
basically
yes. This is a Prescott era thing, wasn't it? If I remember right.
It was a John Prescott thing, and DLUHC
Yes.
is essentially is the same, pretty much the same as what ODPM covered. I
She's
don't
a
think they're
big,
going to
busy
check.
lady.
And we've seen, you know, there's been lots of people who've been going up Downing Street to be told that they're in the cabinet. Jonathan Reynolds, Yvette Cooper, Annalise Dodds, Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy has arrived, but we don't know that these people are definitely going to get these roles. The only one that's been announced so far is Angela Rayner. Peter Kyle has gone in. Rachel Reeves has gone in. Bridget Phillipson has gone in. Wes Streeting. Siobhana Mahmood, who, like Wes Streeting, also had a strong challenge in her constituency. John Healey, Ed Miliband. I haven't seen Ed Miliband, actually. So there's a lot of people going in, but the only one that's been announced is Angela Rayner. So we don't know of any of the others yet.
Thank you
So
for having your finger on the pulse today. Thank you, both of you. See you next Friday.
cheers, cheers, and
Cheers. Thanks,
hopefully
Graham.
with added Malcolm, hopefully.
Yes,
Cheers.
hopefully. I think he's catching up on sleep. He's with us all night on Riverside. Okay, talk to you next time. Thank you.
Bye.
Keep celebrating him. Bye.
Cheers.